From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Investigating and reporting on government corruption and overreach, national security, national and international issues. You're listening to Scott Wheeler and Through the Looking Glass on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello and welcome to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler, broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. And before we get to our expert witness today, let me get to some pressing issues that will set the stage for what we're going to discuss. Many of saw that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi's husband, was attacked in his home, and immediately before even the name of the assailant was known, allegations that it was January 6th all over again were echoing throughout the media as if on cue. And it was startling. We don't know anything about the guy. He lived in Berkeley. We know that. We know his name now. Lived in Berkeley, but we know little else because he has been scrubbed from the internet. We can't see what his conspiracy theories were like. Obviously, the man was disturbed, but we can't. It's not available to us. We can't see it. We can't look at his background. We can only believe what we're told by everyone in the media, and that is that he believed in 2020 election conspiracy theories. Now, this works right into our subject today. We've got left-wingers around the country predicting a civil war. And in fact, a recent, it was last year, a column in the Washington Post declared that America is likely heading for another civil war. The writer of that column, a guy named Dana Milbank, who often uses his column in the Post to promulgate Democrat Party propaganda, he quotes a book that came out in January by a woman named Barbara Walter, not Barbara Walters, the journalist, but Barbara Walter, Barbara F. Walter, a college professor. Mm-hmm. And he quotes her as saying, "We are closer to civil war than any of us would like to believe," unquote. The book by Barbara Walter, a professor at University of California, San Diego. She also once served on a CIA advisory panel, appointed certainly by a left-wing president, of course. According to Milbank, she says that by an intelligence matrix, the U.S. has entered, quote, "very dangerous territory and is ripe for civil war." Many others agree. The tendentious Milbank went on to assess in that column, to assess blame, seemingly on behalf of Democrats, as he vindicates the Democrats and blames President Trump and Republicans. In Milbank's column, he says, quote, "things deteriorated so dramatically under Trump, in fact, that the United States no longer technically qualifies as a democracy," unquote. That was on the pages of the Washington Post just last year. Milbank goes on to cite the opinions of other leftist organizations and declares that Democrats are pursuing democracy while Republicans are leading the nation to autocratic rule. Critics have pointed out that for decades, the Democrat Party has advocated for consolidation of power in Washington, D.C., while Republicans, Trump included, have pursued policies that do the exact opposite and disperse power from Washington to states and individuals, raising questions about Milbank's understanding of reality. Is he ignorant of such matters, or is he intentionally spreading Democrat Party disinformation? We can't say for sure. I've contacted Milbank a number of times. Unfortunately, for years, I've been forced to read his leftist childlike prattle that passes as editorial news. But he will respond, but he refuses to answer questions. Other analysts say that people such as Milbank are the real insurrectionists, helping to create a false narrative about their political opposition, which allows them to take drastic action to stop the so-called insurrection their party created. National security experts also point out that if civil war is at hand, it is typical for the insurrectionists that lit the fuse to blame their enemy for the drastic actions they impose. Now, that dovetails well into our expert witness today, an author named Jim Belcher. His new book, Cold Civil War, Overcoming Polarization, Discovering Unity, and Healing the Nation, is like the antidote to what these guys are peddling here, a civil war. Mr. Belcher has a PhD from Georgetown University. He considers himself a political philosopher, researcher, and writer. He previously served as president of Providence Christian College in Pasadena, California, a beautiful place, by the way, and was the founding lead pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Newport Beach, California, also a very beautiful place. He's the author of In Search of Deep Faith and Deep Church, which won a 2010 Christianity Today Book Award in Church and Pastoral Leadership. Mr. Belcher says in his book that there is a way for Christianity to overcome the current crisis our nation faces. And I think there's few that would argue that the nation is in crisis, that it's not in crisis. I'm sorry. Mr. Belcher, welcome to Through the Looking Glass.
Scott, it's a privilege to be here.
Let's jump into your book, because I think you have really, I know you studied Codevilla, Angelo Codevilla, who first directed my attention to this subject, that there was this buildup, a separation between the ruling class and the country way back in 2010, I believe it was, is when I began writing about these issues. And you quote extensively from Codevilla, who unfortunately just passed away not long ago, and tragically. You've obviously seen this coming. And tell me, in your opinion, where is the nation right now? You say it's a cold civil war. How close are we to it becoming more of a hot war?
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously kind of at a touch point, right? I mean, I think both sides recognize that. I mean, what's interesting about your opening monologue in this accusation that we're on the verge of a civil war is that, I mean, I think it's pretty disingenuous. I think we've learned from the ruling party that whatever they tend to accuse their opponents of, they're doing themselves and they're stoking it. I think it's an easy out for them, right? To, if they, you know, this is what happens when you push back on the ruling elite, then they accuse you of insurrection. They even fake the insurrections if they need to, or they drum up all kinds of hysteria around a civil war. And then that gives them the ability to unleash the national security state or big tech or big government against their opponents. And that's kind of what we've been seeing the last few years. I think the COVID pandemic really made that very obvious for people who are awake and paying attention. So this idea that we're moving into a civil war is somewhat laughable, because the ones that have all the guns and all that have captured all the institutions, have all the finances, all the money, all the tax revenue, they're the ones that are in control of all. And it isn't as if any opposition could conduct a civil war. So I think that's kind of ludicrous on its face. I know why they're doing it, right? So that they can crack down even more. And we're watching that. We've seen that as they've cracked down against doctors, the deplatformed, they've shamed, they've doxxed, they've eliminated from the conversation everybody they could. And then lately, in the last year, they figured out that they can censor people financially and shut people down and destroy people. So I think on its face, it's somewhat laughable that we're on the verge, but I do think the sentiment behind it, or the idea behind it, that we are deeply, deeply divided, is true.
You know, Barbara Walter, the author of the book, How Civil Wars Start, she quotes, and she's coming from the left. She's accusing the right as being the dangerous ones, while glossing over the militant Antifa, saying that they're merely standing up for oppressed people. She accuses the right, whatever she describes as the right, as being the ones at fault here. And she says, but she does point out in her book, nothing radicalized. She's quoting an expert on the Basques in Spain. She says, nothing radicalizes a people faster than the unleashing of undisciplined security forces on its towns and villages. That's why civil wars appear to explode after governments decide to play hardball. Extremists have already embraced militancy. What changes is that average citizens now decide that it's in their interest to do so as well. So you kind of see, just as you were pointing out, it's a pretext claiming that the right or white nationalists or, you know, white militias, as they commonly refer, or the dangerous threat to democracy from the MAGA groups, they are sort of laying the pretext, using it as a pretext to strip people of their rights. We hear it directly from the president himself, and use this as a justification for harsh, federal crackdowns on people who disagree with the ruling class. Do you see it that way also?
Yeah. I mean, what did Rahm Emanuel say? Never let a good crisis go to waste, right? So I think we saw pretty early on when the pandemic hit that there were forces around the world. So not just in the US, but you know, these Davos elites, the World Economic Forum, were already talking openly and writing books about using the pandemic for the great restart, right? So they wanted to change everything, and they were going to use a worldwide pandemic to do it. So it's not a conspiracy theory because it's out in the open. I mean, they're publicizing it. They're making it clear exactly what they want to do and where they want to go. And we saw really early on, I mean, you go all the way back to, you know, whether it was hydroxychloroquine or the ivermectin or any of the alternative medicines to fight COVID, those doctors were immediately censored, immediately shut down because they weren't going along with the narrative. If you push back against masks or anything to do with a lockdown, they would destroy you. And we saw this, as I said, not just in the US, but around the world, and particularly in Europe, doing the same exact thing, almost as if they were singing from the same song sheet. It was pretty remarkable. But I think what we've seen over and over again is that they will use a crisis as a pretext to crack down, or they'll invent a crisis and they'll use that then to crack down on people. And it's been, just as you said, it's been happening over and over, and it's going to get worse. I mean, we just saw this past week, Biden come out and say that in a little known announcement that cryptocurrencies are fair game. If they want to civilly go after cryptocurrencies, they're going to do that. Well, why are they going after cryptocurrencies? It's not because they fear that they're being used in drug deals. Very, very little of it is used that way. They fear because it's an alternative monetary system that gives back power to people. And I'm speaking particularly of Bitcoin, which is an alternative monetary system. And they don't want that. They don't want anybody who can get outside of their control, which is why they're scrambling now to come up with the central bank digital currencies. I think Europe will have them first, but I know that MIT engineers and others are working on our own kind, for the US, a digital currency where they can control everything. They can control what you buy. They can punish you if you use too much carbon. They can punish you if you don't have the right political views. It becomes its own kind of red Chinese, as they used to say, that the Chinese Communist Party social control system. So, yeah, that's where we're heading, and I think it's pretty clear that they're going to use any pretense they can to crack down on any kind of dissent, whether it's big or small.
This is what you pointed out, a couple of things that are very curious. At the time, during the early days of the pandemic and the talk of using hydroxychloroquine to suppress the disease, the coronavirus, and the reaction from the media of President Trump encouraging people to take poison. Well, to people like me, that was one of my first indications of how ludicrous that claim was, because I'd taken hydroxychloroquine. Every time you go to the jungle, anytime there's a concern about malaria, you take hydroxychloroquine as a prophylactics against getting malaria. It suppresses the malaria as soon as you take it. So, and it is so readily handed out. Every time you'd go to the jungle, you'd take 30 days worth with you and take it. And so when I heard that this was dangerous, when I heard people saying this is dangerous and poisonous, it made me think, why are they saying this? There must be a million people, including you guys like me, former U.S. Army infantrymen who worked in the jungle and took hydroxychloroquine, who know that this is a lie. Why would they spend so much credibility trying to convince people that that this is really, really happening? And let me go to a break, Mr. Belcher, and let you have a shot at answering that if you have a theory about it. We'll take a short time out. We'll be right back with more on Through the Looking Glass with Jim Belcher, author of a new book. Stay tuned.
TNT Radio's Rick Munn.
It doesn't really matter who you bank with. The axe is being wielded for bank branches. Less people are going in. I believe there should be a presence of banks there because there's a lot of old folk. They don't want online banking. They don't want to speak to a call center in Timbuktu. They want to go in their local branch with their little book and talk to a human being and get their cash out. And why the hell not? They've supported you stinking, rotten corporate dogs for decades of their lives. So give them a break now. They're in the twilight of their lives. Don't humiliate them. Don't threaten them with bank apps or they can't bank. And don't tell them to go outside in the rain and use the ATM. For crying out loud, show some respect for your elders. It's one of the reasons why our society's in the position it's in now. We don't respect our elders.
Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
The story behind the biggest election takeover in history.
We're only now being able to finally confirm exactly how this worked.
Mark Zuckerberg and his wife are donating more money to local governments ahead of the election. $100 million on top of a $300 million gift.
The most money any individual has ever spent to win a presidential campaign in the history of our country.
The election was bought way before Election Day.
They stole it fair and square. They changed the voting rules in the middle of the game.
A nation divided, rigged.
It was a rigged election. People have to find out what happened.
At SalemNow.com.
A cashless society means zero cash. 100% digital currency means your life is 100% dependent on a power surge and the internet. Every cent you receive will be recorded and every transaction tracked. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio. I'm Scott Wheeler, broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. And if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email. If you go to the TNT Radio website, you can go to Through the Looking Glass, and there's a link where you can click and send a message, and I will personally see the message and respond. And so if you want to reach us, you can get us at the TNT website. Now, back to Jim Belcher. He's author of The Cold Civil War: Overcoming Polarization, Discovering Unity, and Healing the Nation. Going into the break, Mr. Belcher, we were speaking of why would the media say things that are so demonstrably false that any thinking person could realize it's not true and that it can be easily debunked, like in the case with hydroxychloroquine. There must be millions of people who took hydroxychloroquine, and either in the military when they were going into highly malaria infected areas, etc., or even adventurous people who go into the jungle. Why would they say something that is so easily proved false, do you think?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a cynical answer and an even more cynical answer. obviously that, you know, these vaccinations were eventually going to get emergency authorization, and that was going to depend on the fact that there was no cure or there was nothing out there that could protect people against the virus. So they had to make sure that none of these things that would work were even available so that they could get the authorization and rush these vaccinations through. So that's one thing. So they just, you know, if doctors were able to get on the airwaves and talk about what great success they were having healing people or keeping them from COVID or keeping them off ventilators, then there's no way they get the emergency authorization. So that's the other thing. A more cynical response is that the companies, the big pharma, is making very little money off of hydroxychloroquine. It's past its patent, so there's really no money. And they were going to wait until they could have something where they could make money. But I think, you know, the bigger thing is that this is the way our ruling elites are. And I talk about this a lot in my book, is that they cannot allow any opposition or any opposing voices, because most of what they're building is a house of cards. And it will fall down if there's any discussion about it or if anybody can kind of pull one card out. And so they know they cannot allow that. And so they all have to stay on the same. They have to keep the narrative going. They have to talk off of the same sheet of paper. They cannot allow anybody to challenge that, because it would challenge what they're doing. And the whole vaccination and the whole way they ran the pandemic was to get a much, much larger agenda passed, and they couldn't allow anybody to get in the way of that.
What this is causing is more distrust, and it's sowing this distrust. For example, I opened the show with this incident that happened at the Pelosi house in San Francisco, whereby Pelosi's husband was attacked with a hammer by an intruder. And in normal times, you would, as a journalist, I would have natural skepticism, or I'd want to know more information. But in this case, my immediate reaction was, something sounds fishy here. This just doesn't, it smells fishy. It doesn't seem like something that, you know, a man living in a man so wealthy living in a house wouldn't have even the slightest security measures, like in a security alarm that millions of Americans have at their modest homes, that notify the police, and that he couldn't lock himself in a room when the alarm went off. This just seems so bizarre. The skepticism, less than 2 weeks before an election, the skepticism just boils over immediately. What's going on here? I know you're familiar with the story. Do you have any reaction?
Yeah. I've heard it. I haven't researched it, but it's just one of a kind, right? I mean, it's hard not to be cynical anymore and distrust anything it's put out there. You see this with the different race hoaxes, right, that happen, and then they're almost always disproved within a month or so. It's sad, and that in order to get their agenda across, there are not enough racists. There's not enough violent people. There's just not enough of these so-called MAGA nationalists who are crazy for them to get enough things in the news. And so they just invent them. You know, they just make them up. I mean, and it's funny, because some of them are just so bad, you can see through them so clearly, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it's almost like we're living through a daily episode of the Babylon Bee, right? Where these things are just kind of put out there, and you're like, oh my gosh, who thought of that? I mean, that's like so sophomoric. But unfortunately, for a large part of the population, these types of hoaxes, these setups, these entrapments work. And it's sad, because people that tend to end up in jail who are gullible and got entrapped into the different security state measures. And that's what's really sad. But I think what COVID has done, and what the pandemic has done, and the lockdown and the distrust over vaccines and on and on and on, has created a massive crisis of trust in our medical establishment, and the pharmaceutical companies, and our government and high tech. And that's going to be the hardest thing to repair. That's going to be the most difficult thing to bring back together. And I'm not sure they care. I mean, I think at some point, it's like, I quote this in my book, where I think it's a Harvard professor says, look, we won on the left. We won. Get over it. And now all we're trying to do is figure out what to do with the dissenters. Well, that's difficult. You have 50% or more, could be more, who are dissenters. And what do you do with the 50% of the country? Would you continue to silence them, lock them down? It's just amazing to think what would have to happen and what largest scale, the type of censorship, the shutting down free speech, free assembly, and eventually a financial type of control that's going to have to happen in order to silence 50% of the population in the U.S. and around the world. And you're seeing these populist movements now kind of push out of this and get out of the straitjacket. We may see that in less than 2 weeks, the elections here, as the votes overwhelm what can take place. We're seeing it around the country, around the world, as different populist movements, like in Italy, are taking back power from these neo-globalists who are kind of wrecking the world, not just their countries, but the whole world.
We're speaking with Jim Belcher. He's author of the book Cold Civil War, Overcoming Polarization, Discovering Unity, and Healing the Nation. Let me ask you about healing the nation. What is your thoughts and ideas? That's basically what your book is about, is how to get past the polarization and how to fix this. And you have a Christian sort of solution to it. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so I spend really two-thirds of the book laying out the problems in the polarization and the Cold Civil War. And then the last third of the book, I do get into solutions. And it really means returning to what the founders wanted in the true sense of the word. And I lay that out and explain it, because I think we've lost any understanding about the genius of our founding and how that sustained us for a good 100, 150 years. So some of it's returning to that, but then I do have chapters on how important it is for us to become a country of faith. I wouldn't get into the argument of whether we're a Christian country or not, but we have always been a country where religious belief has undergirded our constitution, our grounding. It's been where we get our sense of truth, our human rights. The whole idea of natural rights is grounded in that. And so it's almost an act of retrieval. I have a whole chapter and to say, hey, this is what the founders wanted. This is what sustained us. This is the only thing that's going to renew the external constitution, which is the external covenant, as Robert Bellah used to say. That's the constitution. It has to be a spiritual renewal that's going to take place, because without it, we don't have what it takes. So there used to be this saying, John Witherspoon, who was one of the early presidents at Princeton, used to say that the republic needs liberty, liberty needs virtue, and virtue needs religion. And he meant Christianity. And if you work that backwards, that if you lose Christianity, you lose virtue. And without a virtuous people, they can't sustain liberty, because it takes a self-governing people. And without liberty, you don't have a republic. And that's the problem we've in. They've cut the roots off over the last 100 years of religion that sustained the project. And now we don't have the constitutional republic that our founders had bequeathed to us. And so part of the solution is a massive revival in our churches, in a return to our grounding, which was in Christianity, which is the only thing that can protect the rights of not only the majority, but minorities as well. I'm not necessarily hopeful, but that's what's going to take.
When you say religion and Christianity, you really are, I suspect you're referring to Judeo-Christian values, the Western interpretation of God and rights that come
from that's right. I mean,
God,
it's Protestant, it's Catholic, it's Judeo-Christian, right? It's all the streams that kind of fed into our founding, along with the kind of the Enlightenment, the good Scottish Enlightenment side of constitutionalism. But yes, we had a people, particularly in New England, who came from a certain region in England called East Anglia, who came over and had a real strong religious sense. This is the city on a hill, had a real strong understanding of how covenants worked in their congregational churches. And that eventually developed a culture and a people who came up with our founding, 150 years later. So Alexis de Tocqueville, the Frenchman who was the great observer of America, said there were two foundings. There was the founding of the Puritans, And then 150 years later, there was the second founding in 1776, and then the Constitution that followed thereafter. And those two have to be held together.
The concept of promoting this idea of kind of a national revival or a turning back to Judeo-Christian ethics, how possible, how likely do you think that is at this very tumultuous time?
Well, there are days where I'm extremely hopeful, and I see all kinds of kind of populist uprising, and I see people who want to return to the founding of the country and the faith that was that we instilled in people to help support that. And there are days where I think, you know, the church is becoming more and more woke and is following the culture more than it's following the scriptures. And that's really why I wrote the book. I wrote the book for pastors, Christian leaders, people who may not have had time to study political philosophy, to understand the conversations that have gone on, don't understand that behind what's happening with the ruling elites, kind of the oligarchs who are in control, is a political philosophy and an eroding of our founding principles that have allowed them to kind of take over. And then if we don't get that back, we're in big trouble. But I mean, you know, look, revivals are ultimately things that we pray for, we act on, but ultimately God has to do it. And so it really is a call for Christians to return to their roots, return to the gospel, and cry out and ask God to bring a revival. Because we know through the history of America that whenever revivals came, social, political, and economic transformation happened soon after. And I think that's what it's going to take to reverse the course we're on.
As we come up on our break at 20 till the hour, top of the hour, we're talking to Jim Belcher, author of the book, Cold Civil War, Overcoming Polarization, Discovering Unity, and Healing the Nation. What, Mr. Belcher, do you think happens if this revival doesn't take place and we continue on the present course we're on? What happens next? What can people expect to see from the government? And, you know, whether it's a Republican, whether Republicans take over the House and Senate and continue with their weak and fecklessness and dealing with Democrats, or what do you see happening? What should Americans expect, and what should the world expect to see happening here?
Yeah, I mean, I think if some of the populists and those who are kind of on the nationalist side of things get into power over the next few weeks and years, you're going to see quite the pushback. I mean, I think if what we've seen has been startling to us now, I think the pushback will be even greater. And I'm not talking about the Republican Party, because most of the Republican Party is part of the establishment, part of the uniparty, and they don't do anything about the problems that we have.
At the very least, they come to Washington with good intentions and then become enamored with the adulation and the prestige and suddenly start seeing things from the ruling class perspective.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And so a lot of it will depend on how many of the people who get into office who really recognize what's going on at our borders, what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on with our monetary system, you know, what exactly is going on with the national security state. I mean, it's going to take those types of people, but there's going to just be a big pushback. So you ask where we're going. I mean, I see that people can push back, but it is going to take a massive populist uprising of Christians and non-Christians who recognize what's going on to push back. And I think it's beginning. I hope it continues, of both parties, left and right, that can understand that this is a uniparty in Washington. A lot of what goes on between Democrats and Republicans is just political theater. And I hope they continue to push back. But I also know that the things that the ruling elites have, you know, the high tech in their back pocket, big pharma, the national security state, are pretty powerful things. I mean, and if we get to a point where there is a central bank digital currency, we get to the point where they have that kind of control over us, it's going to be a pretty Orwellian kind of scary situation for us all, because ultimately their goal is a type of transhumanism. I think we're only in the beginning of stages with the kind of remake that they want for the entire world. And I don't think it's going to be pretty, but this is where the church has to stand up, has to understand these arguments, has to read my book and other books so that the pastors who are training their flock know how to disciple their people before it's too late. And it's, I don't think it is too late, but we're getting very close to that day.
So you see this as a lack of organized religion or religious figures organizing their flocks to take decisive action and corrective action in this case. We're coming up on a short time out, so we'll deal with that question on the other side of the break. But it seems to me that the majority of people know what's happening to their country, but the people who are committing this seemingly have almost all the power here, and that's what is making it impossible for even the most honest of people to try and make legitimate change. We'll take a short time out. We'll be right back with more on Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
The left is up in arms again, figuratively speaking, and it's because Amy Coney Barrett, a Trump appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court, is writing her memoir, and the fascist left can't allow it to be published. They want Barrett punished because of her vote to dismantle Roe v. Wade. Penguin Random House has reportedly coughed up $2 million for the literary work, and that's prompted a letter signed by 536 so-called professionals from the literary world, including some Penguin employees, entitled We Dissent. It reads, in part, "We recognize that harm is done to a democracy not only in the form of censorship, but also in the form of assault on inalienable human rights. We're calling on Penguin to recognize its own corporate responsibility commitments by reevaluating its decision to move forward with publishing Barrett's forthcoming book. We cannot stand idly by while our industry misuses free speech to destroy our rights. Anyone want to place a bet on the outcome of this? I'll take that bet. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you prevent wildfires.
Dude, I've got this. I've been camping since I was 5 years old.
But I am a camping influencer.
You know what? I'll bet you $5. Assistant Smokey, what is the best way to put out a campfire?
To put out a campfire, drown with water, stir, drown again. Then make sure the fire is out cold by feeling with the back of your hand.
Wait, really?
I'll take the $5.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Children in poverty, each one unique, each one full of dreams. They're our hope, our future. They're the reason Children International exists. When the whole world changed, we developed new ways to reach children and families in poverty during these vulnerable times.
I'm learning every day.
I'm healthy and strong.
To learn more, go to children.org/help today.
Every year, Steve Faircal climbs the stairs at the John Hancock Center in Chicago, 94 floors to the top.
It's called the hustle up the Hancock.
It's hard to believe when you watch Steve today that a few years ago, his lungs were failing and he was fighting to survive.
For 8 hours a day, someone was pounding on my chest to try and keep my lungs clear. I honestly don't think I had more than a couple weeks to live.
That's when Steve received the gift of life, a double lung transplant made possible by an organ donor.
After I got my new lungs, I started doing things that I had never been able to do. I never knew that breathing could feel this good.
Steve climbs to honor his donor and to raise awareness for organ, eye, and tissue donation.
Wouldn't you like that when you left this beautiful planet, that you could save a few lives on your way out? It's an incredible gift.
Imagine what you could make possible by leaving behind the gift of life. Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
For the news and views you can't hear anywhere else,
it's TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler, broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. And joining us, our expert witness, is Jim Belcher. He is the author of Cold Civil War, Overcoming Polarization, Discovering Unity, and Healing the Nation. And we, going into the break, we were discussing the fact that most people in America know what's happening. A majority of people know what's happening to their country. They understand the decline. But the people who are causing the decline seem to have all or most of the power. Do you agree or disagree with that?
No, there's no doubt that certainly on the federal level, in a lot of things that impact our lives on a daily basis, like taxes and whatnot, that yes, that's absolutely right. And it is easy. It's easy to get super frustrated and give up. But it has been amazing over the last couple of years, or at least the last year, to watch people get mobilized, get involved in local politics, start getting involved in elections, getting involved much more. And I think that's a start. But I also think that there's a lot of apathy. You know, I'm out here in California and my kids are in their 20s and they talk about most of their peers are completely apathetic about the country, about really about anything, and don't have much drive. So I think there's probably about 30% of the country that's really woken up over the last couple of years to what the uniparty and what the oligarchic elites are doing. But I also think there's a hardcore 30% on the other side that's pushing back. And then you have this kind of 40% in the middle that's just kind of clueless to what's going on. And that's the group that needs to be awoken. But, you know, and it's just not politics that we're going to take back the country. I mean, it's building strong institutions, the little platoons, as Edmund Burke said. It's getting involved in building healthy churches, healthy schools, healthy colleges, healthy families, healthy marriages. It's getting more aware of what's going on with our monetary system and beginning to opt out to with the control that they have over us when it comes to loans and mortgages. I mean, that's for another radio discussion. But I do. Yes, I understand the frustration. It's very hard. If you stick your head up, you stick your neck up, you're going to get it whacked off. And it's a very, very scary time. But I think there's a lot of other things that we can do to rebuild our constitutional republic.
Well, it's kind of this theological approach. It's sort of like, isn't it like sending the Boy Scouts in to take on the Gambino crime family?
That's good. I think so. If you're talking about on a national level with politics, I mean, it does appear to be that daunting. And there are people who are willing to do that and to be censored out of existence. I get it. But I still think the church, you know, the church has a responsibility to disciple people in more than just a narrow band, a real narrow sense. I mean, their whole life discipleship is how do we act as citizens? How do we act on our jobs? How do we think about all the other times we're not in church? So what does it mean to think Christianly about politics, about citizenship, about our country, about our founding? I mean, those are topics, at least in kind of the more conservative theological circles that I run, that are not touched on at all, because there's a great fear of any type of getting involved in politics. And so I think it's important.
Is that fear, do you think, because of the fear of offending people, or the fear that getting involved in politics would dilute the message of the religion itself?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, I think there is a fear that they might divide people. And I'm not talking about preaching politics from the pulpit, unless the topic in the passage of the Bible brings it up, right? I mean, I do think there is more than just discipleship, is more than just about salvation in our one-on-one, you know, relationship with God. Right? It has to do with how we relate to one another, how we relate to the systems and the institutions, how we relate to our government. All those things. I mean, if you go back and read early Puritan sermons, they weren't talking about revolution and the nation's founding and the need for liberty and all those things. They weren't talking about it in every sermon. But when it was appropriate, they dealt with those issues and they were not afraid of those. And then my guess is they taught citizenship and what it meant to live in the world, in the culture, they taught those things at other times. You know, whether it was Sunday night sermons, whether it was Sunday schools, they still had to do discipleship, because it's important that Christians act Christianly in every sphere of their lives. And we just don't do that anymore. And particularly in the political realm, where most of our pastors just aren't even trained in the categories to know how to do it. So I think there's some fear. So they just kind of stay away from it.
I think that's part of it. They do stay away from it and devote themselves to work that they know is, you know, pure in motives. But since you have that mindset, how difficult is it going to be to move some of those people into the political sphere to help to recruit and teach and promote the ideas of a national unity again?
I think it's going to be real difficult, but you know, generally, well, there has to be enough of a pain point for them to kind of realize they're going to need to do it. And I just hope that it's not too late when that happens. You know, when the church, I thought that when the church was shut down, particularly here in California for almost a year and a half, that the pastors would finally say, okay, enough is enough. You have no right to shut down our churches. And there, you could count the churches on one hand that went against what the state was saying and stayed open and got, you know, got sued and fined every week for doing it. But there were a few brave souls, but the vast majority just said, oh, Romans 13, we got to obey the government and we're going to stay shut down. I thought that would have been enough to wake people up and pastors for them to get armed with arguments and understand what was going on, but it didn't. And I don't know what it's going to take. Maybe it's when they're put out of business, maybe when their bank accounts are seized, maybe when they're censored in the pulpit. At some point, their liberty will be infringed upon and they're going to say, okay, well, we've got to get trained in this. We have to understand, we've got to push back. We've got to get our troops mobilized, but it may be,
you know,
too late. I just hope it's not.
It's funny that you mention Romans 13, because I was prior to my becoming a Christian, was raised Jewish. I was at the Fulda Gap in the U.S. Army when Billy Graham visited the Soviet Union and said, basically endorsed the government of the communist government by saying, Romans 13 says we're to obey the authorities. And there was I had a bitter debate with someone in my unit who was a big fan of Billy Graham. And I said, how could he possibly use this to justify communism? It's outrageous. And I thought upon reading the scripture that it was not intended to obey government authorities. It was to obey the authorities of the church. Is that your understanding, or am I misreading that?
No, you know, I think Billy Graham was misunderstanding it. And I think that what Romans says is basically what Paul is saying is, to the extent that they obey a higher authority, they're doing what God wants. And when they're not doing that, then they're outside of his authority. And so they are to be an instrument of good to the people they rule. If they become an instrument of bad, then they no longer have the authority to do that. And so God doesn't say, I give you blanket authority as a government, do whatever you want, be as unjust and as cruel and as evil as you want, and everybody's going to obey you because I've just given you that blanket authority. That's not what Paul is saying. To the extent they are doing what is good for people, then obey them. But in the case of like shutting down churches, but allowing strip clubs in Vegas and gambling places where you can buy alcohol liquor stores to stay open, but churches had to shut, that is not doing good to the people that they rule over. And so that is an illegitimate law and doesn't need to be obeyed. That's not how most people see that. What's that?
Wasn't that just the perfect dichotomy? The closing of churches while bars, strip clubs, and casinos were open for business and no one was laying a finger on them. To me, it just represented the clear juxtaposition of good versus evil.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and you know, I talk about a speech that Justice Alito gave where he brought up that very thing. And he said, look, the great fear he has as a Supreme Court justice is we're moving to a point in time where it's not just freedom of speech that's being curtailed, but freedom of religion. And, you know, over the last 20 years or so, the government has seemed to say, look, it's great. You we'll let you worship, in this case, over, you know, online during the pandemic, but we're not going to let you just say and do anything that you want. So we don't have complete freedom of religion the way we're supposed to. And he was raising the alarm a few years ago. I talk about that speech in one of my chapters, and we're at a dangerous place. So again, as I said, Scott, I thought that would have just been clear enough, right? I mean, I had a discussion with my church elders at one point during the pandemic, and I said, look, the true church is marked by two things, the preaching of the word and the administration of the sacrament. Now, I understand how you can preach the word over the internet, but I do not understand how you can administer the sacraments properly. You can't do baptisms, you can't do the Lord's Suppers. And to go a year and a half to be robbed of those sacraments for a Protestant where the real presence of Christ is visibly displayed and experienced is not being the church. And so we allowed the government to dictate what kind of church we were going to be. And we were not allowed to be the church we wanted to be. And so my wife and I and my family, we had to drive an hour to find an open church. We drove an hour away to find the church that stayed open. I just thought that would have been enough. It's the proverbial frog in the kettle. But like I said, I think it's going to take something like taking money away or taking tax status away or something that really, really hits even closer to home that will kind of wake up pastors.
Do you think the people shutting down the churches, they obviously, Democrats had no reservation about that because people who go to church typically don't vote for them. But maybe they were fearful of shutting down bars and casinos because those are their voters. And if they angered them, it could cost them elections. It seems maybe natural, but they had no problem tormenting people of faith, but they did not want to mess with the centers.
And Alito pointed that out. It was selective, wasn't it? They were very clear about who they were willing to shut down and kind of persecute during that time, and those so that they weren't. That tells you a lot.
This is you're listening to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler. We are speaking with expert witness Jim Belcher, author of the book Cold Civil War: Overcoming Polarization, Discovering Unity, and Healing the Nation. And while I see that there is some optimism in your book, Mr. Belcher, I find that it's maybe misplaced optimism. There may be more favorable outcomes. One being if people who tend to agree with one another congregate in particular parts of the country, all go to certain regions of the country, and then you hold a plebiscite vote and 70% say, we want to be left alone. And then you can declare that we'd like to be left alone by the federal government. Maybe that's kind of a more realistic solution. And maybe it's possible even that the Democrat run rest of the country ruling class run part of the country would say we're happy to be rid of you go along your own way. Is that a possibility, or do you think that that could only end in a violent outcome?
You know, I've always, even when I was a pastor, I'd always be accused of being optimistic. I think because I do believe in the providence of God, and I do believe that God's not done with our country and, you know, our founding. But there are days where I think that at some point there's going to be a split. If there is, hopefully amicably, you know, I think before those who believe in a grounding leave, those who believe in transcendent truth leave. I think at some point, if the populist uprising takes place and there's more kind of conservatives, those on the right that swing elections for decades in a certain direction. I think you might see the left, particularly places like California, that they decide to secede first. How long they'll leave the other states alone, I don't know. I mean, one thing you would notice is that they don't, I think conservatives tend to have a live and let live attitude. Hey, just leave us alone. We want to live our lives. But it doesn't always work the other way. I mean, if there's heresy for those in the Uniparty, they're going to root it out no matter what. I mean, they just can't allow it to happen.
You're absolutely true. To me, it's one of the most striking things about our current time is the people who want to control everybody's life are calling the people who want to be left alone fascist. It's such contrarian situation. Right. We're almost out of time. The book is Cold Civil War, Overcoming Polarization, Discovering Unity by Jim Belcher. Thank you so much for being a guest today.
My pleasure. It's been a joy.